My guest today on The Queso is Brian Taylor. He's Vice President of Publishing over at La Mega Media, Inc. in Ohio. You can find him at lamegamedia.com on Facebook and Twitter. I hope you stick around so you can hear my talk with Brian Taylor. The Queso Podcast is a place where cultura intersects with language and personal stories. The aim of this podcast is to just come together and talk about issues and maybe try to make sense of them in our mind. So grab a drink or a snack, sit back, and enjoy my conversation today with Brian Taylor. I'm here talking to Brian Taylor. He is the Vice President of Publishing for La Mega Media, and it's all Spanish. He and I met years ago on a press tour of Pittsburgh many years ago, and had the pleasure of speaking with Brian, and I was pleasantly surprised to know that he was bilingual, although he doesn't really think that he's bilingual, but his accent is on point, as I've told him before. And being that we're talking about queso or queso, I really like to highlight that when someone learns Spanish or another language and really gives honor to that language by giving as much as they can to speaking it correctly. Now, the Mega right now is distributed in 4 cities in Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and Columbus, Ohio. And there's plans to maybe expand in the future to other areas, which is really great. Brian, thank you for being with me today.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's definitely queso.
Yes. And it's funny because queso has even become like a dish, you know, queso. I guess it's like Velveeta melted with salsa.
Yes, queso.
Now let's get into it. Print is dying, and I see that you guys are still doing print. How are you approached by people that you work with every day when you have to go into the Hispanic community and maybe talk to them about the publication?
Oh, well, I mean, in certain ways, the actual print side of the publication is a breath of fresh air to people because, you know, you have everybody's on their phones, and that's a good thing. I mean, the fact that technology continues to expand and progress, I believe, is good for all of us, especially those of us who may not have the financial means to, you know, to be able to communicate publicly by traditional means. Now the internet opens up an entire different way for us to be in instant contact around the world. So I think that's extremely important. But the print side of things is an interesting dynamic too, because some people like the idea of being able to physically hold the news, to thumb through it, to you know, it's harder to do that when you're on an app on a phone. It's harder to thumb through pages and find the thing that you want. That the act of doing that, or like crossword puzzles, or busca palabras, those are all things that are much easier in a print version to experience.
Exactly. And do you find sometimes like your subjects, they even like seeing themselves in print after an interview? Do you find that they have like a different attitude towards it?
Oh, absolutely. There is a prestige that people feel that comes with seeing themselves or their stories in print. It has a regalness to it, I would say, that is that's unique. Keep it, you can put it up on a wall, you can frame it. Yes.
It just feels so authentic.
Yes.
I remember my days back in Detroit working for El Central News, and my dad coming home on Thursdays, the day it came out in print, with a bunch of them under his arm. He said, my daughter's in here, and he's handing them out to his friends. You know, there's just something about that.
Absolutely.
There's just so many sides to what's going on right now, in particular to what happened to this young woman, Vanessa Guillen, who was in the army and was murdered, and later her body was discovered. And it's such an unfortunate, sad state of affairs when you think about it, because she was serving her country. Never in my wildest dreams, though, did I think that I would be seeing things on social media come through where Latinos or Hispanics or people that I know who are Latinos were going to start comparing it to the Black Lives Movement. and we're angry about there not being enough attention, and why aren't we marching, and why aren't you speaking up if she's Latina? What is your take on that?
Well, so first and foremost, I think the starting point is it's not our military, and it's not our America, really, on a certain level. And I think that the more we start to understand that, the more we'll understand why certain things happen. And I think the dynamic of understanding it is different for Latinos who identify more, whose heritage is recently not from the United, you know, from outside the United States. Black people were forced to come here, and we have been a component of this society from its very beginning, part of the builders of it. It wasn't just us, but a huge piece of the creation of this country was done for free by black people. So we have a different stance on how we view America. It's not the land of opportunity. It's the land that has oppressed us. And I think that truth is also the case for Latinos, but I think because in some cases, depending where you come from in Central or South America, there is a certain dynamic where people are partially forced to accept this idea of being American and the American dream in order to be able to try to fit in a country where even the more immigrant-friendly governments, regimes in government still are anti-immigrant overall in their stances and their policies. So I get it. People identify with the military or don't see it in the same way that I might see it. But it's not an accident that sexism and racism and these sorts of things are present in the military, which is an armed force that is the extension of the U.S. government. And the U.S. government, especially, my brothers and sisters from Central and South America can testify, this government's history in those countries is very, very dark in their moves to overthrow regimes and basically cause foment in those countries while simultaneously stripping them of their natural resources. So that attitude and that behavior is no different in the ranks, or at least among the, or that's the culture. So I think we should be opposed to what happened to her, and I think that there's a natural place of solidarity between black people and Latinos when it comes to the abuse that we face by the state, or the abuse that we face by individuals, and very little is done about it by the state.
Have you seen this example of Latinos kind of going against blacks when it comes to events like this? Not just with Vanessa Guillen, but have you seen that example elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think it exists. I think it's part of the reality, again, the different stories of what certain Latinos face. Because when people think of Latinos, they see a certain grouping of people. But there are a lot of Afro-Latinos in the United States, and there are countries where, you know, if you come here and no one hears you speak and they just see you, they'll assume you're black.
Right. You recently found out you were Puerto Rican or had Puerto Rican.
Yeah, about maybe 15 years, between 10 and 15 years ago, I was at a family reunion, and it came up. One of my aunts, told me the story of how my great-grandfather came from Puerto Rico and came here and connected with a Sioux, an indigenous woman, and so began that chapter.
Oh, wow. So also Native American blood.
Yes.
And now, how did it change you, if at all, since you found that out?
It actually didn't. I mean, it gave me just another source of another piece of pride and personal connection. But I've ever since I was 18, I'd say, I've been a supporter of immigrant rights. I've actually, before I even knew I was Puerto Rican, I went to a number of different activities and events for Puerto Rican independence and for the some of the jailed political prisoners in the United States, like Lolita Lebron and Rafael Cancel Miranda, who were, you know, leaders of the Puerto Rican struggle for sovereignty. So I've been involved in those things all this time, and then to come back and find out, oh wow, that's also my roots, was just icing on the cake, I would say.
And what in those times compelled you to take those actions and support those causes?
I'm a true believer in no one is free while others are oppressed. And I think that we are natural allies. I say we, and when I say we, I mean Black people and Latino, although I happen to straddle both now. But Black people and Latinos are natural allies. We both face the same type of oppression. The thing is, though, is that this country, because of its racist history, no one wants to identify with being anything but white. If you can possibly identify as white, and if some of your blood is European, whether it's from Spain or you know, Middle Eastern countries, which, you know, have gotten mixed into South America, like if you can show or if you can look like you're white, this country strongly pressures you or encourages you or makes you feel like you have certain benefits by doing that, just like it stripped away people's culture, identity, and language in the 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s.
Do you see the tide turning at all on that right now?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I can't even say Latinidad because people have begun to identify so much with their past that they don't even necessarily call themselves Latinos. Some people do. Some people call themselves Latinos. Some people call themselves indígenas. Mm-hmm. And identify with their roots all the way back to, you know, before colonizers came here. So mm-hmm. I think it's a big moment of pride. And I think that the energy and the confidence to express your heritage is aided by these struggles against police brutality and for Black liberation. I think when the Black struggle advances, we bring everybody with us, and the confidence from what we're doing in the streets gives other people confidence. That's why these statues of so-called Christopher Columbus and other monuments are starting to come down.
And the opposition to that has been stronger than before.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the two things are simultaneously true and always have been in history. As the oppressed people of the world, or in this country, we can say specifically, start to stand up more to assert their rights and start to recognize their power, our power in our numbers and our power in our ability to bring society to a halt, the more we gain confidence, to me, the more the tiny minority, the loud, armed, tiny minority of right-wingers, ultra-right-wingers, and white supremacists begin to also respond. So I would absolutely agree. They're definitely much more out here. They have a president right now who eggs them on. And, and so they're out here more and more. There's actually a rally that's coming up in Columbus, I think next weekend, organized by these militia right-wing type people.
Now, what do you think gives the right-wing militia type people so much confidence in their leadership right now? Like, what could it be about that leadership that gives them so much confidence?
I don't think they have confidence. I think they're acting out of desperation. The America that people like Trump and other right-wingers want to go back to is going away. and racism is less acceptable, anti-immigrant bigotry is less acceptable, and the government is being pushed further and further to have to acknowledge that. And I think that scares the right wingers, and I think they are mobilizing to try to hold on to and defend their last, they're trying to make their last stand.
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with religion as well. I mean, unfortunately, they do have relatives and friends who are Christians, you know, and I'm not opposed to that. You know, I'm a Christian. I believe in God. But it's like a blind Christianity where this is a right-wing movement, and that in some way in their head equals doing God's will. And that's what I think bothers a lot of people. It's like you have to question, even if they say they're aligned with your beliefs, there's so much more to it.
Absolutely. And religion, I think oppressed people, I think people on the right side, they use, or, you know, people believe and they have a code of ethics that they follow. It's like the religion, if you broke it down, say, you know, like, you know, if you broke down bread, you would find flour and, mm-hmm. and remnants of water. If you broke down religion, it basically is a code by which people can treat each other the right way. But I think that fundamentally with these right-wing forces, it's not about religion. I think religion is a cover that they use to justify the desire to maintain control over other people. And that's how it was during slavery. No one, or I won't say no one, because then
it's a blanket statement.
People who are less intelligent might actually believe that this has something to do with Jesus or what Jesus wanted. But the leaders of these movements, these right-wing movements, know better. They know that this is about maintaining white supremacy. And they use whatever catchphrases they can to convince people who are religious that there's a religious basis.
Right. All you have to do is go back in history and see how these slave owners were quote-unquote upstanding citizens of their church and were also preachers and were also considered, you know, God-fearing, but had slaves.
Exactly.
And also, exactly. And would do things like, you know, make babies with their slaves and, you know, beat their slaves. And that to me is the farthest removed from what Christianity is.
Absolutely. I mean, so that's in the United States. But again, that history is not something that's known by Latinos. So, like, how can we make it, how can we draw the connection mm-hmm. so that people understand? And to me, if you look back at the Crusades, and you look back at how Catholicism was used to basically, as an excuse, to tear down and destroy
right.
Culturas nativas, and, you know, in throughout South America. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. Like, to pretend that the Pope or the Vatican of those times had anything to do with, and, you know, there were exceptions like Romero and other people, but, you know, but the idea that they were doing this on a religious basis is just, you know.
Right. It was to, you know, plunder and take what they could and stake a claim where people already lived. I wish that I would have been taught more in my school, in my, you know, elementary school about my culture. And I think it's changing now, but even just a few years back, what was the issue in Arizona where books by Latino authors were being taken out of schools and libraries?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is shocking that it would still be happening. But again, like you said, it's, you know, we should be unified as Latinos and Blacks and come together, because I think when we start dividing, we're doing exactly what the oppressor wants.
Absolutely. And to me, you said something really important just a minute ago. So here's the problem for America. America has a very brutal history. It's it was established with blood and bullets and musket, and it was established through colonization and domination of people who were just living their lives. So the problem is for them is they never have faced and owned up to their history of brutality. So since they haven't done that, and that's how they've treated Latinos and Black people throughout history, they've never owned up to it. They've never organized a real apology, and they've never given reparations of any kind or done anything to make up for the huge harm that they did to entire generations. I mean, they decimated. There are some indigenous populations that don't even exist now. They literally murdered them to death away. Right. So until they face that history, they don't want us to learn it.
Right.
They have to keep up a facade that America's was made for freedom and this and that, you know, and they can't face their history, because anyone who reads it seriously will question what's happening now. And that's their problem. That's their challenge, is how do they get us to accept things as they are, you know?
Yeah, it's just pretending it didn't happen. You know, we heard this about the Holocaust too. if we will it away, it didn't happen. And it's just amazing how that is trying to still make its way through our society today. And what I think what's disheartening to me on a personal level is seeing other Latinos really not think through the issues and maybe dig a little deeper and see, hey, you know what, maybe I'm part of this oppressed group, you know, maybe if I dig a little deeper I find out something different. Come to terms with that, Brian. Like, now we have there's such a thing as not being a racist, and then there's such a thing as being an anti-racist. How do you differentiate the two?
Well, so I think that in some ways I understand that argument that people raise. I think the main thing is, if you know there's something wrong, to try to educate yourself, to try to identify with and learn from those who are experiencing that oppression, and to find the way, the best that you can, to fight alongside them. And just connected to that, I hear a lot of people who use the term white privilege, which I'm opposed to. Okay. I don't use it.
Okay.
And I think that it cuts across something. So I think that a white person being able to walk down the street and not be harassed by cops is not a privilege. It's a human right. And I think if we start to talk in that sense, not that white people have privilege over others, but that the government and the society is denying rights that others should have, it makes it much more easy to mobilize and fight around together. If you tell a white person that you have privilege, especially in this economy, in this world, which very few people in general have true privilege or like living lavish, but if you it makes it something that we can all fight around and unify around. Tell a white person instead that George Floyd in Minneapolis, who was killed by the cop who sat on, who put his knee on him for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the problem isn't that he didn't have privileges. The problem is he didn't have rights.
Exactly.
He was denied his rights. And I think it's like that for everything. It's like that for immigrant rights. It's not that white people or people who have citizenship have privilege over undocumented workers. It's that undocumented workers are not being given the rights that they deserve.
In other words, you're saying, as a human being, we all have those privileges, but some of us are not given the right to enjoy that privilege.
No, I take out privilege altogether.
Okay.
Yes, I would say that as a human being, we all have these rights.
Okay. Okay.
And those rights are denied to some of us.
The conversation needs to change. The vocabulary needs to change in order for us to see the change. It's the way that we're approaching it, then, that is also causing more harm in many cases.
I agree, because I think that if like, I'll give you an example. Let's say a second generation Mexicano who is kind of got a better, you know, he's got a decent job, he's able to work without persecution, you know, he's got papers and things like that. But still, he's second generation, so maybe he's making $12 or $15 an hour. Now, if you try to tell this person who's barely getting by that they're privileged, you know, as opposed to a first generation salvadoreño who has no papers, has to struggle, earns below minimum wage, yes, they're in different economic positions. But it's really not that, you know, the first person has privilege. It's that they've been able to get rights that are being denied to salvadoreño. And if you tell the second generation Mexicano that, hey, let's fight for the rights of this other worker, it's a lot easier for them to not feel defensive. But if you start telling them, oh, you're privileged, or da-da-da-da, then now you created a situation where, well, why am I privileged? And people start being defensive about it.
But there are certain rights. There are certain situations where being a black man, right, you experience life differently because of the way people treat you, correct?
Absolutely.
And because if a white man or a white woman, which I think the white woman has even more rights in some situations than a white man, she's approached differently in a situation. And that is just like that's just the way it is right now. I mean, is there anywhere we go where we don't see that right now in the United States?
No, I think it's everywhere in the United States for sure.
Yeah, so and then, you know, put the Latinos in there somewhere in the mix, in the middle, or, you know, there's, like you said, Afro-Latinos, and there's Latinos that identify more with being white. I think that therein is where lies all the anger and confusion. It's like, why are you identifying me with this, you know, a minority race? Why I'm supposed to be white, you know? And I think it leaves those people in the middle thinking, where are my rights? And that's, you know, going back to the Vanessa Guillen topic, I think those people that are opposing that, or not opposing it, but like bringing that to light and kind of chastising the Latinos that were supporting Black Lives Matter after George Floyd, and chastising them for not making the same kind of noise for Vanessa Guillen, are those Latinos that think, hey, you're leaving us out of the equation, when in reality, you're already in there. You're part of this. But how do we make people see that? How do we make people feel that?
Well, yeah, I don't think we can make them. I think that's part of the challenge for people to understand. So the way that George Floyd was killed was very brutal. Mm-hmm. We can agree on that.
Yes.
But it wasn't necessarily more brutal than other people who were killed by police, black people, and there was no major demonstration. Right. We don't get to choose the moment where society, where normal everyday people get so upset that they've had enough, like it's the last straw. We don't know when those moments are. Was Tamir Rice in Cleveland, was his death any more horrible than Melvin Murray, who was a person in Cincinnati who was killed by the police unjustly?
So many cases, so many, right?
There's so many. So
yeah.
A lot of times, some of the people who are complaining, well, why are you demonstrating for this person and not for this person? Well, the answer to that is, then let's call an action. We can. it's not one versus the other, and that's what this country tries to make us think.
Right.
It's not black lives over white lives or black lives over Latino lives.
Right.
If we can get on the same page and fight for everyone who is unjustly killed by police or raped or murdered while on any job, whether it's military or a factory or anywhere else, we can fight together, and there's no need to create these false arguments about one versus the other.
Right. One thing to understand with the Black Lives Matter movement, and you know, when you look at the images, George Floyd and the video, I could barely look at that. But when you look at that and you think, well, there's so much more behind this that got us to this point. You know, everything that we've been talking about, you know, it starts with the person that called the police on the person. It starts with the way the police reacted because he's a black man. The way that they reacted, the way that they, the type of force that they use, it's all systematic. So it's already ingrained in the culture of how people are going to approach you for looking a certain way. You know,
absolutely.
And so that is why when people say, "Oh, it's not Black Lives Matter; it's All Lives Matter," and we're, you know, I think of course All Lives Matter. The reason that we're highlighting Black Lives Matter is because for too long, it's been accepted that we look at black people a certain way and treat them a certain way. And that's unacceptable.
Yeah.
That's unacceptable. Like, it's gotten to the point where that it was one drop too many and everyone had to come together. I don't know if it was because everyone was in quarantine and everything just built up. Whatever it was, it happened. And it's to me, it was time. It was time for, you know, the outbreak brought out voices that maybe otherwise would have been too busy in their daily routine.
Yeah. I mean, so here's one little example. So I used to live in Birmingham, Alabama. And at the time, it's a long story, but I won't tell a long story. I'll make it short. But I used to work in a coal mine. And while I was there in Alabama, there was a poultry workers situation where a number of workers in this factory, many of whom were Latino, many of whom were Centroamericanos, were basically being, the safety conditions were terrible. I mean, you had people who couldn't even close their hands. Like, when people shook hands, they would literally just hit each other's back of their hand because you don't have enough strength in your hands to even close them because of the conditions in the plant.
Wow.
So these workers were trying to figure out how to stand up and fight. But that's a whole nother story. The reason why I mentioned that is because while I was there visiting those workers, because I was trying to build solidarity for them and report their situation back to my coworkers so we could see if we could do some kind of joint action or something to defend them. We were going through people's neighborhoods too, like knocking on doors and introducing ourselves and trying to find out people's stories.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this particular couple of neighborhoods that were vast majority Latino and vast majority of them working in those factories, in that factory, I can't remember if it was Purdue or Tyson. I think it was Tyson.
Mm-hmm.
Workers could not go out on their porch. Like, a worker would sit, you know, a couple of workers get together and hang out on each other's porches,
mm-hmm.
and the cops would come by and try to arrest them. Or if they're drinking in their yard, on their front porch, the cops would come by and basically try to arrest them or try to intimidate them, ask them if they have papers and stuff like that. And that's kind of the reality of, like, how that wouldn't have happened if those were just white people getting off work, sitting on their porch, drinking a beer.
Hmm.
It wouldn't have happened. So in those situations where we say defend immigrant rights and support undocumented workers, the equivalent would be if somebody said, well, support everybody.
Right. Exactly. That's such a great example. Such a great example, you know, and to get it across to people, I guess it depends on the community that they're coming from and putting it in context for them. And I think we can do that like one person, one street, one community at a time. And it's the kind of work that you're doing with the newspaper and your publication and your online presence. I think that's making a difference. And I really appreciate that you continue on, you know, at a time where a lot of people might want to give up. It seems like an endless battle, but it sounds like you've been in this for a long time.
It has been a long time, but I am always inspired when I find people who think the same way and want to do the same things. So meeting you in Pittsburgh, and then us keeping contact, and now getting to a point where, bam, you decided that you were going to put your voice out there. That gives me, encourages me to continue doing what I'm doing. So I think we help each other. We give confidence to each other.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brian. And, you know, like I said, this started out as just a play on words, you know. We're going to talk queso or queso. However way you want to say it, we want to say the same thing. You know, we want to say the same thing, which is we stand in solidarity with each other and with each other's struggles. And, you know, one person, one community at a time, and not giving up that fight. You know, hand the baton to the next generation. What you were doing out in Alabama reminds me a lot of Cesar Chavez, what he was doing with the farm workers, going door to door. And that's what we need. We need that. We need the feet on the ground and people just, you know, taking up that, you know, burden that someone has left before us and just keep it going. So thank you, Brian. Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it. I think I might want to visit again with you and talk about your time in Alabama. That sounds really interesting. If you would allow me.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, I'm thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure. And I agree, let's not make it the last time.
Okay, Brian. All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Take care.